Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 2nd of February, these are our main stories. Several people have been killed and hundreds more injured in a massive gas explosion in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A Malaysian prime minister who was jailed for his part in a multi-billion dollar financial scandal has had his 12-year prison sentence halved. Also in this podcast, as Ukraine's second city of Kharkiv comes under renewed attack by Russian missiles, we meet the people living and learning underground.
Running alongside the platform on the metro, there's a corridor of classrooms. Here, when the sirens wail for an air raid, no one has to move.
Later on, we hear how strike action is causing severe disruption to public transport in Germany, and we hear a tale of suspected avian espionage. We begin this podcast in Kenya, where a series of gas explosions in Nairobi have killed at least three people and injured nearly 300. A large area has been turned into a charred landscape. Officials say hundreds of liquefied petroleum gas, or LPG canisters, had gone up in flames, igniting a huge ball of fire. This man is one of the injured.
I got burned by an exploding gas canister as I was trying to escape. It exploded right in front of me, and the impact knocked me down, and the flames engulfed me. I'm lucky that I was strong enough to get away.
Anne Soy is our senior Africa correspondent. She is at the site of the explosion in Embakasi, in the southeastern part of Nairobi.
People have gathered here just trying to understand what exactly happened. I'm standing near the gate of the area where the explosion started. I counted at least 10 lorries there. We are told that the lorry that exploded had LPG gas. And the amount of damage, I mean, the area is a compound of about half an acre that's completely burned. All the vehicles there are burned. And on the other side of the road, about 50 to 100 meters away, I can see a block of flat that the facade was destroyed. I can see on the rooftop black metal protruding. I'm told it's part of a car that was blown there. Things were flying in the air, gas cylinders, metal parts, including a shipping container. So people here are in shock. I have just met one woman who had come here to look for her friend. She's walked into the house. It's completely burned, and she's wondering what happened to her friend who was pregnant and had a child.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, is following developments.
I think given sort of the scale of the explosion and the speed at which the fire moved towards the blocks of flats, it's somewhat lucky, I think, that more lives weren't lost and people did manage to get out pretty fast, although there are, you know, a lot of people being treated in hospital. And we understand it took about 9 hours for the fire services to put out the blaze because it had spread over quite a large area.
Indeed. Well, do we have an explanation as to what caused this initial explosion?
Well, we were told by officials that that a lorry that was carrying gas exploded inside this facility. Now, we understand that gas cylinders are filled at that place. But of course, there are lots of questions going on about why this facility was there, you know, in a densely populated area of the capital, Nairobi. And now a government spokesperson, Isaac Mwaura, has told the press that the facility was illegal and he suggested corruption was to blame.
It's quite unfortunate that, as you can see here, this is a yard, an illegal gas filling yard, which had not been licensed, but then they continued to operate in such a residential area, high density area. And it's quite unfortunate that it has happened. Just showing how sometimes we have weak enforcement institutions, and of course the element of corruption, which has now led to the death of three of us Kenyans.
So he says corruption may be to blame. Surely it's the responsibility of the Kenyan authorities to crack down on that. Are they making much effort to do that?
Well, in this particular case, it's early days. But of course, the fact that they're saying that three applications were put in to construct this facility and they were rejected. We don't know why, but presumably because there are so many people living in the area. It's a residential area. But I think once again, Kenyans are kind of, you know, seeing or potentially seeing the rule of law being bent. And as the spokesperson said there, if corruption is to blame, you know, it's a long list of issues in Kenya where bribes and corruption then lead to disasters. And another example would be the roads in Kenya. And recently there was a lot of concern about the high number of deaths on the roads, fatal accidents. And the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission just last month said that it was very much the fault of police officers taking bribes and turning a blind eye to, you know, vehicles that were in a bad state or drivers not doing the right thing. So it just seems that there are rules in place, there's anti-corruption measures, but when money's involved and bribes are paid, the rules sometimes are bent.
That was Will Ross. The Ukrainian city of Kharkiv has come under renewed attack by Russian missiles in recent weeks. Ukraine's second largest city is so close to the border that sirens can often sound after the missiles hit. Air defences have next to no time to react. Now, almost 2 years into the full-scale war, and with no end in sight, parts of life in Kharkiv are now moving underground. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from the city.
Russia's war has transformed everything in Kharkiv, including childhood. Nika skips in her pink wellies through a neighbourhood that's been shattered by missiles. Russia is so close here, when it fires at this city, the missiles can't be stopped. But six-year-old Nika is cheerful, because she's on her way to kindergarten. It was closed for 2 years because of the danger. Now, it's moved underground. Running alongside the platform on the metro, there's a corridor of classrooms. And this is a whole lesson on laughing. It's the first chance many of the children have had to play together for months. Here, when the sirens wail for an air raid, no one has to move. Nika's mother Olga talks a lot about Kharkiv's strength and its resilience. But that doesn't stop Olga being scared for her daughter.
It's better underground. It's safe. A child can continue with a more or less normal life in these conditions. The parents won't worry, and the enemy won't get us here.
So life beneath Kharkiv is expanding.
In the yard here, there's a huge construction site in a hole in the ground. It's at least the size of a football pitch, and there are men at work here. They're drilling and they're welding and they're digging. But what they're making here is extraordinary. This is a giant underground school being built so that children can study here in safety.
Ihor Terekhov is the mayor.
The missiles most often used to wreck our city take 40 seconds to fly here.
That's no time to evacuate a school.
I really don't want us to move underground. This is a forced safety measure. This war will end when we win. But in the meantime, children have the right to study, so we're building these schools.
A war that once seemed impossible now shows no sign of ending. So Kharkiv has to adapt. Back at preschool on the metro, Nika is in her element. The teachers are too, trying to make this subterranean life seem normal?
What can we do? The woman in charge wants to know if we want our children to grow up here in Ukraine.
Come and visit us when there's peace, she says, and I'll show you our normal kindergartens. Then suddenly, Natalia starts to cry. It is all so sad, Natalia says. But it is okay. Everything will be okay.
Sarah Rainsford reporting from Ukraine. There are fresh signs that a deal for a new truce between Israel and Hamas could be getting closer. Israel has repeatedly stated that it won't stop its war in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed. But now Qatar, acting as a mediator, says Hamas has given its initial approval of a hostage-prisoner exchange. For more, I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Nick Beek.
There is optimism, and that's reflected certainly on the front pages of all the newspapers here. If you go on to the various news websites, this is the story people are talking about, that behind the scenes momentum is building towards a deal. Certainly we're not there yet, but as you mentioned, the latest sort of hope and optimism has been generated, I think, by the foreign ministry in Qatar, saying that in their dealings with Hamas, they believe that Hamas has looked at this sort of proposal that's been put together, and their initial thought is that this is something they can work with. So, I mean, this is by no means a done deal. And, of course, another complication here is the internal politics within Israel. You've got some members of the government on the far right saying that they'd walk away if any Palestinian prisoners were released as part of a deal. But, I mean, it's clear that some will have to be released, it would seem, if those hostages who were taken on October the 7th are to be released. So we're certainly not there yet, but there are potentially encouraging signs, I'd say, Nick.
Meanwhile, Nick, as we say every day, the fighting has continued overnight in Gaza. Where's the focus particularly at the moment?
Yes, well, the Israeli military, in giving their latest update, have been talking about hitting Hamas both in the north and the south, but also in the centre of Gaza. We know there's sustained activity around Khan Yunis, the city in the south. You've got the Hamas-run health ministry saying more than 100 people were killed in Israeli strikes overnight. Interestingly, this morning, the defense minister here in Israel is saying that when their operations have concluded in Khan Yunis, the IDF will move further south towards Rafah, where, of course, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to because it's right on the border with Egypt. People thinking they'd be seeking safety there. They were instructed by the Israelis to move there. But the defense minister here saying that will be the next focus of attention. So I think there is a discrepancy. We get this sort of tough talk from ministers and the military saying that they won't let up. But it's clear that there will have to be a pause in the fighting if there is some sort of hostage release deal, which would see potentially a ceasefire of 6 weeks or so. That's the sort of duration people are talking about, Nick.
That was Nick Beek. It was one of the world's biggest financial scandals. Between 2009 and 2012, $4 billion was siphoned out of Malaysia's sovereign wealth fund. One of those people jailed for his involvement has had his prison sentence halved. The country's former Prime Minister, Najib Razak, was convicted of money laundering and abuse of power. Mickey Bristow, our Asia-Pacific editor, told us more.
You say that it was one of the world's biggest financial scandals. It was. It related to a fund called 1MDB. Essentially, the Malaysian government sold bonds to investors in order to raise money for economic development. That didn't happen. Much of the money was just siphoned off. Some of it went to fund political campaigns, which is where Najib Razak comes in. But a lot of it was used to finance a luxury lifestyle for one of the main people behind it, a gentleman called Jolo, who's currently on the run, by the way. He used the money to buy a super yacht, private jet, hotel stays, jewellery. Even used it to fund a Hollywood film, The Wolf of Wall Street. Ironic, that one, isn't it? Najib Razak in 2020 was convicted of taking $9 million and putting it into his personal bank account. That's what he got 12 years for. That's the sentence which has been halved now. He's also had a reduction in the fine he had to pay from $40 million to $10 million.
And Mickey, do we know why his sentence has been reduced and what reaction to that has been?
In a word, no. The review board which looked at this fine and sentence didn't say exactly, or didn't say at all really, why it had reduced the sentence. And that's a question many people are asking. Exactly why? You know, all these crimes were committed, you've been convicted of taking money. Why have you had your sentence reduced? Also, questions are being asked of the Prime Minister in Malaysia at the moment, Anwar Ibrahim, and whether there's been some backroom dealings involving him, because Najib Razak's former party, or his party still in actually, is now in government. So there is a suggestion of political manoeuvring behind the scenes, which a lot of people have criticised, and you can understand why.
Indeed. Mickey, remind us how Najib Razak's conviction was seen at the time.
It was a groundbreaking conviction, actually. I was in Malaysia on the first day he appeared in court, and you would get people coming out of other courtrooms just to see this former Prime Minister being led up into his own, into the dock himself. You know, they were astonished that a man who'd been accused of corruption for so many years was finally being brought to trial. So there was a great celebration when he was convicted, actually, and a sense that here is Malaysia can convict somebody as high as a Prime Minister, somebody who's held the office of Prime Minister for corruption.
Mickey Bristow. Millions of commuters and travellers in Germany have had their journeys disrupted as public transport workers have come out on a one-day strike. Bus, local trains and tram stations across the country, apart from in Bavaria, are at a standstill as workers demand better pay and conditions. It's the latest in a series of strikes affecting transport in Germany. Last week, intercity trains ground to a halt for 5 days, and on Thursday, thousands of flights were cancelled. We heard more from our Germany correspondent, Damian McGuinness.
It's trams, it's buses, it's undergrounds, which means for a lot of people, they can't use public transport to get to work. And in some regions, even they're closing schools. So it does have a big impact on people. But I think the broader impact is really the fact that this is just one of a string of industrial actions across the country. We've already had yesterday airports across the country were affected. More than 1,000 flights were grounded because ground staff went on strike. We've already had the train strike in some regions. We've had hospitals seeing industrial action. We've had state-run kindergartens closing. So it's something now, over the past year, really, that German people are becoming increasingly used to. It's not something we used to see very often because it used to be a very good system of negotiation between workers and employers. But to a certain extent, that is breaking down because mainly of inflation and people are really feeling the squeeze. So a lot of workers are saying it's time to increase wages. But really also, when you look at for consumers, it's not all bad, because what we have with low unemployment and a lack of workers, it does mean that workers are feeling like they can ask for more money. German wages have traditionally have stayed low for a long time. So you could argue it's time for a wage rise. The problem is that these strikes are affecting the German economy slightly. I think it depends how long they go on from here on, really. We are seeing signs of breakthroughs in some sectors, but it depends if workers and employers can get down to the table and resolve some of those issues. If they can, I think the economy will stay at this level. It's not a disaster zone, but it's not looking great. But I think growth is predicted for this year. If strike action gets worse, though, that could well have a broader impact on how Germany is seen broadly, really, when it comes to the economic performances here in the country.
Damian McGuinness. Still to come, we will hear why the Grammy Awards will have a new category for African music.
Afrobeats, amapiano, other music from the continent has become very, very much a part of what's happening with pop music and popular music.
I'm a piano, piano, it's a big vibe, but the girls them know. I'm a piano.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour. And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. An Italian mafia boss who's on a list of Europe's most wanted criminals has been recaptured in Corsica after he escaped from prison last year. The authorities in France and Italy confirmed that Marco Raduano had been detained in Bastia, the capital of the French island. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
In a joint operation run by Italian and French special police, Marco Raduano was arrested on Thursday in Corsica. At the same moment in southern Spain, a similar operation picked up one of his leading lieutenants. Raduano, who's 40, came to the public eye last year when he escaped from prison in Sardinia using the time-honoured method of knotted sheets. He'd been serving a 24-year sentence for extortion and drug trafficking. The Foggia crime syndicate, of which he's said to be a boss, is sometimes described as Italy's fourth mafia, after the more famous organisations in Sicily, Calabria and Naples.
Hugh Schofield. The mother of a boy who killed four pupils at his high school in the US state of Michigan in 2021 has taken the stand at her involuntary manslaughter trial. Jennifer Crumbly and her husband James are the first parents of a school shooter to face felony charges in the United States for the actions of their child. Ms. Crumbly has denied the allegations.
As a parent, you spend your whole life trying to protect your child from other dangers. You never would think you have to protect your child from harming somebody else. That's what blew my mind. That was the hardest thing I had to stomach, is that my child harmed and killed other people.
For more on this story, here's Will Vernon from Washington.
Back in November 2021, Ethan Crumbly was just 15 years old when he shot dead four of his fellow students and wounded seven others. Just 4 days before the shooting, he had been given a handgun by his parents as a present, a 9mm weapon that, of course, then became the murder weapon. Now, testifying in court, Jennifer Crumbly said that it was her husband that purchased that handgun and that it was intended for use at a local shooting range. Now, prosecutors allege that Jennifer Crumbly ignored her son's downhill spiral into serious mental health problems. On the morning of the shooting, her and her husband got called into the school after some concerning drawings were discovered. There, they were told that their son required counselling, but they didn't take him home and they took no action. Of course, he went on to carry out that mass killing. Now, prosecutors also say that Jennifer Crumbly did nothing when her son asked for help with his mental health problems. He told her that he saw demons in the house. She said in court that she thought he was just messing around. Now, Jennifer Crumbly denies all allegations of involuntary manslaughter. She says she couldn't possibly have foreseen what her son was about to do. Her husband, James Crumbly, will be tried separately. And as for Ethan Crumbly, well, he pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and last month was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Will Vernon. When Ferdinand Marcos Jr. took office as president of the Philippines in 2022, he said he would make the country safe for journalists. Under his predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte, the country developed a reputation for harassment of journalists, most prominently with Nobel Prize winner Maria Ressa and her Rappler news site. So, has anything changed? Irene Khan is the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression. She's visiting the Philippines at the moment and spoke to Victoria Uwankunda about what she's been finding out.
There is definitely a change of tone with the new administration. It is not haranguing them in the way in the previous one did. It's more open. However, there are some deeper problems that persist. Last year, when the new administration was in charge, four journalists were killed. There remain, of course, impunity for crimes committed against journalists before that time. There is also some remnants from the previous regime in that some of these journalists, particularly community media, are tagged, red tagged, as they say, which is basically branded as being pro-communist or pro-insurgency. And then they can be attacked. They can end up in prison under anti-terrorism charges. I met a young community journalist, 25 years old, who has been now, she was arrested when she was 21, and now she's 25 years old, and she's being accused of being a communist fighter, of course, which seems quite unbelievable. But there she is still, and still hasn't come to trial yet. So yes, there are a lot of problems to be solved from the previous regime.
So what needs to change? What to improve the conditions for the journalists or anybody for who is a fan of freedom of expression?
Well, first thing that needs to change is the mindset. The journalists have a job to do. They're going to speak the truth. They are going to have certain opinions, the government, and they're going to criticize the state. So there's an issue of mindset. The second is that journalists also have to be supported. Access to information, there is a presidential order, but actually getting information is difficult. And very rapidly, journalists who are writing critical pieces are being labeled as fake news, disinformation. Then they still have criminal libel laws and cyber criminal libel laws that were used against Maria Ressa. Maria Ressa has one charge still pending in the Supreme Court and cyber libel. And that has a chilling effect. So government has to realize that democracy requires a free, independent, diverse, pluralistic media and create that enabling environment. I think Marcos has started in the right way. He's much nicer to journalists. He's more open to them. But he has to do more to show his real commitment to media freedom.
Arin Khan there. For the first time, African music is going to have its own category at the Grammy Awards taking place this Sunday in Los Angeles. There are three new categories for this year's awards, including Best African Music Performance, featuring some of Afrobeat's global superstars. Harvey Mason Jr. is the CEO of the Recording Academy, which runs the Grammy Awards, and he told us why there's now a new category of Afrobeats.
All the ideas for what we do with our awards generally come from our membership. Does a lot of work to listen and understand what's happening. And so, obviously, Afrobeats, Amapiano, other music from the continent has become very, very much a part of what's happening with pop music and popular music.
Amapiano, piano, it's a big vibe, but the girls, them know. Amapiano, piano.
You're seeing collaborations with some of today's biggest Western artists, with artists from the continent. You're seeing the music consumed here by the fans, really globally, actually.
But some might say Afrobeats has been around for quite some time now and would want to know, I want to know, why did it take so long before these genres from the African continent were featured in the Academy?
Well, really, the Academy honors music that is released in the U.S., so there's been a change in technology, which has allowed music to be created anywhere and consumed anywhere.
Make me slip, make me harder, make me lose my breath, make me water.
Music from the continent is prevalent now everywhere around the world, and the Academy is now a new Academy that is attentive, it's fluid, it's adjusting, it's pivoting. And so we take great pride in the fact that we are paying close attention to what's going on globally with music, not just in the West. And so this is something that we're really excited about.
We've got some of the best, if not the best of the best at the moment from Africa. You've got Davido, you've got Ayra Starr, you've got Tyler, you've got Burna Boy, Asake, Olamide. That is like the top of the top of the moment in Africa in terms of music and entertainment.
It seems like our voters did a good job. We have to make sure we have the right voters and voters that are knowledgeable and understand the genre in order to be able to vote and reflect and represent the genre.
Harvey Mason Jr. speaking to Victoria Wankunda. Police in India have finally released a pigeon that they detained for 8 months after suspecting that it was part of a Chinese espionage ring. The BBC's security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, told us more.
The poor pigeon was detained for 8 months because it had been found near Mumbai with two rings tied to its leg and apparently a message which looked like it was in Chinese. And the suspicion was that this was a pigeon which had been used to covertly send messages, somehow carrying intelligence, perhaps, from India. And as a result, it was detained. Now, it seems to have taken 8 months to establish that that wasn't the case. And it was actually a Taiwanese racing pigeon that had escaped and made its way somehow to India. It obviously got lost and has since been cleared. But it does actually go to the issue about both concerns over spying and even potentially the role of pigeons in carrying messages and being pigeon spies.
Yeah, I mean, there is a long, long history of that being done, going back way to prehistory almost. But it does seem a big bit of a stretch to suspect that pigeons would be used, a very low-tech form of espionage, isn't it, in the 21st century?
Well, it is, but it's fascinating because, of course, the thing about pigeons is that they can find their way home. So you can drop them in one place and someone could give them a message or tie a message to their legs and it could get back. Now, that's been used for message carrying, as you said, for millennia. It was used in the Second World War by Britain. They dropped pigeons behind enemy lines, as it were, in occupied Europe to get information back on occupied Nazi Europe. But actually, pigeons are still being used. I mean, there have been cases of pigeons being used by the CIA as late as the 1970s, and there have been reports of spy pigeons. The Iranians said they found one in around 2008 near one of their nuclear sites. India and Pakistan have both traded accusations about spy pigeons. And it is true, actually, that the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army there, about 10 years ago said it was training something like 10,000 pigeons. And in that case, it was less for spies. But the theory was that if there was some kind of cyber attack or something which took down regular communications, then actually they might need to rely on pigeons for communications again. So they may still have their role, believe it or not.
Gordon Carrera. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with news of this week's Happy Pod.
In this week's edition, he became known as King Yuxi Kong, the monkey that went walkabout from a Scottish wildlife park and became the subject of a huge search operation and a world of memes. It's fine, he's safe now. The welcome discovery of four previously unknown emperor penguin colonies in the Antarctic. The woman who's become an internet sensation riding her motorbike the length and breadth of China. The people in Oregon trying to help out the red-legged frog on its annual migration to breed. And we'll hear from one of the groundbreakers at this year's Africa Cup of Nations. All in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, the 3rd of February.
And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Graysmark, and the producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye. Thank you.